back up. So thank you very much. It's a great pleasure to be here. So I'm going to talk about scalar tensor black holes of two kinds, the wild black holes that we don't really understand much about, and the isolated black holes that are more tractable. So when I say scalar tensor, I'm thinking about the general scalar tensor theory. So this is the outline of the talk. I'm going to first give you some motivation for all these things that I'm going to show you. I'll probably talk very briefly about the notions of horizons, apparent horizons. So I'm going to talk about dynamical black holes. So the relevant notion of horizon is apparent horizon, not event horizon. Then I will show some beasts, these cosmological black holes that are very strange. And they have apparent horizons that evolve. They appear, disappear in pairs. So this is in scalar tensor gravity and F of R gravity. And there are some strange black holes also in general relativity. And the last part is this isolated scalar tensor black holes. So why do you bother about this? So in general, a horizon, in the words of Rindler, is a frontier between things that are observable and things that are unobservable. So the horizon is one of the, on the most characteristic feature of strong gravity. So it's the most impressive feature of a black hole, and that's more or less what defines a black hole. So there are several textbook kinds of horizons. There are, well, Rindler horizons, acceleration horizons. There are black hole horizons. There are cosmological horizons. And of course, as you go through the literature, you find event horizons, killing horizons, inner horizons, outer horizons, Cauchy horizons, apparent trapping, quasi-local, isolated, dynamical, slowly evolving horizons, and so on. So there is a vast body of literature on these, and some notions of horizon are a bit more specific for particular purposes. And for
universal horizons.
Yeah, universal horizons, and then okay, you get Horovitz with Einstein ether, so there you get very, very different structures. Okay, so for the standard stationary black holes that we know from the standard general relativity courses, most of these horizon notions coincide. So the classical black hole mechanics and thermodynamics that was developed in the 1970s focuses on stationary black holes and on event horizons. But why not to look at dynamical situations? And after the 1930s, 1950s, we realized that dynamical situations are important. And they're very important today. So think of gravitational collapse. So you form horizons, and they are in that moment before the collapse or during the collapse, they are extremely dynamical objects. Or think of having a merger of a black hole with another compact object, possibly another black hole or a neutron star, then the horizons are changing, changing faster, and we're very interested in predicting gravitational waves that come out of this kind of phenomena. So there, the horizons are highly dynamical. If you're interested in problems of principle like Hawking radiation, well, for a Hawking radiation of a large black hole, not much changes, but when the black hole becomes small, there is back reaction of Hawking radiation, so the black hole becomes dynamical. So in the later stages of evaporation, it becomes very important to take into account the back reaction. It's a highly dynamical situation. So at that point, the event horizon doesn't do anything. You need to talk about some kind of other notion of horizon. Or think any time you have black holes that interact with non-trivial environments, for example, strong accretion or strong emission, and you have to take into account the back reaction, you have dynamical situations. Another motivation why people started studying black holes that are dynamical is that they were looking at special variations of fundamental constants. For example, in scalar tensor gravity, John Barrow and collaborator looked a lot at variations of the gravitational constants. So they produced some black holes. And this turned out to be dynamical, so not static black hole usually. Then there is another old problem, which may be a bit academic, but is kind of interesting in principle. It's the problem of how the cosmic expansion affects a local system. So if you have a system that is weakly bound, essentially you have no effect on the local structure from the cosmological expansion. But if you got an object that is strongly bound, like a black hole, well, do you have any effect? Essentially no effect if the black hole is small. But what if the black hole is large, maybe has a size that is comparable to the Hubble radius? Not true for astrophysical black holes, but for primordial black holes, you could have had a situation like that, where a black hole forms, and this size is not too small compared to the Hubble radius. So do these black holes grow or not? There is a similar problem in cosmology when you actually do formations of large-scale structures. And early on, you're looking just at Newtonian problems. But if you want to look at the effect of the cosmological expansion on these very large scales, you have to take into account some kind of interaction between the cosmological expansion and the local system. Anyway, if you want, this is just a more academic problem. Then these kind of dynamical black holes are solutions that describe inhomogeneities in a cosmological background came up again if you think of explaining the acceleration of the universe without dark energy. If we try to get away from dark energy, one option that has been studied was looking at back creation of inhomogeneities in general relativity. So in that case, it would be nice to have some exact inhomogeneous models in which you can actually study something and make some statements. And these are just the models, of course, but there is so much ambiguity in this formalism that it would be nice to have some more exact model in which you can actually study what you are stating. Another idea, again, to explain the acceleration of the universe without dark energy, is that we live in a giant void, which mimics the accelerated expansion. So in that case, you can consider analytical solutions of general relativity that are related to black holes in an expanding universe. So in this case, this void must be very large if you wanted to explain the acceleration of the universe. So it is actually not small compared to cosmological scale. Okay, in that case, people use Lemaître-Mahon-Bondy solutions, which actually can contain black holes. So these are all different motivations in which you can actually worry about a black hole in a cosmological background, which is what I'm going to talk about for a while, for a good part of this talk. So in these situations here, especially in the dynamical situations, the notion of event horizon fails. And if the so-called background is not a Minkowski space, you have to talk about what is the internal energy of these black holes, because you want to do some thermodynamics. And you have to be very careful to define the internal energy because you don't have an isolated black hole anymore. So you have to use some notion of quasi-local energy. And that's also related to the notion of horizon. So I already told you that the notion of event horizon, black hole event horizon, becomes useless for anything practical when you actually have dynamical situations, because the event horizon requires to know the entire structure, the entire causal structure of space-time, so you need to know all the future too. And this is not relevant for astrophysics. So it's fine if you have a stationary or static black hole, nothing changes, so you can know the entire structure, it's forever the same. But when you actually form the black hole, or the black hole changes, you cannot know all of the future of space-time to just locate the event horizons. So black holes are also a very important object in astronomy. They play, in astrophysics, they play very important roles in astrophysical systems. And now there are claims that we're going to detect gravitational waves within the next decade or maybe 15 years. I don't know how to take these claims, but they're becoming serious, and the people that work on the experiment have done a lot of progress. So what do you need to detect these gravitational waves? You need to build templates. So you need to build databanks of templates because there is a large, there is a low signal-to-noise ratio, so there is a large noise, and you need to know what you're looking for. So you need to build these templates and compare your templates with the data to otherwise you will never extract the signal from the noise. So you need to predict these gravitational waves, and one of the best candidates is the merger of two black holes. This gives you a strong signal, a clean, fairly clean signal. And to predict this, what do? You need to locate the horizons, and the horizons are not the event horizons of black holes, because to know the event horizons, you would have to know all the future structure of space-time just to locate the horizon. Of course, your code crashes after a while, so you cannot know all the future. So people use marginally trapped surfaces and apparent horizons instead. So for them, there is no question about event horizon. The event horizon is some academic concept, and that's not something that they use. So they use marginally trapped surfaces, apparent horizons. No question about that. And I mentioned primordial.
Leonard, so marginally trapped surface is not the covariant concept.
It is covariant, but it depends on the foliation. So the apparent horizons or trapping horizons are covariantly defined. So they're not coordinate dependent, but they are foliation dependent. Actually, there is a bit of ambiguity. I will be talking about both. So I'm talking about the tube in space-time, and I will also be talking about slices. Yeah, so that depends on the foliation. Now, there is no question it depends on the foliation. So you can take Schwarzschild space-time, foliated with a weird foliation, and it shows no apparent horizons. And that's Schwarzschild. Okay, we know everything about that. Of course, the foliation is arranged in a weird way, but you can do that. So there is a big drawback about apparent horizons. They are foliation dependent. Most of the times here, I will talk about spherically symmetric space-time, spherically symmetric black holes or space-times. So the problem is alleviated because, well, you take a spherically symmetric foliation. There is not much that can go wrong. But in principle, apparent horizons are foliation dependent. So that's the biggest problem of apparent horizons. And I'm not claiming that apparent horizons are the best thing and that we will always use apparent horizons. Is that probably is the best concept that we have so far. Maybe there is a better one, but I don't know any.
Then the answer depends on mass foliation. Think,
yes.
So, I mean, it doesn't make sense to talk about it.
It's not great, but there is no other way around that.
Some of these numerical people always resort to because nobody has anything better.
They have to. They have to. I wish there was something better, but I don't have anything better. So the dynamical horizons of Ashtekar that came up in loop quantum gravity are essentially apparent horizons that are space-like everywhere. And that's the best thing that the loop quantum gravity people came up with so far. So yes, it's not great. I'm not saying if you get some idea for something better than apparent horizons, follow it because this is a problem. Anyway, it's not great, it's not ideal, but let's go on with that idea. Just because we have got nothing better, like the numerical relativity people. Okay, yeah, I mentioned the primordial black holes in the early universe, so they could, if there were primordial black holes in the universe, and again, it's another if, they could have had a scale that is not small compared to double scale, so they will be very dynamical and not a very small object. So the important thing there is how do these black holes accrete and can they grow and become bigger?
So that would really should be.
Pardon?
That would really should be a
critical, right? It may not be a very important problem. There is a small community that works on these black holes, but they would accrete. So the problem is, can they accrete? They would accrete, and if you can make them accrete faster and grow faster than the cosmological background, then they may become important. Maybe they never existed or they're not important. We don't know. But there are some people working on that. Okay, well, then there was in the literature some discussions about the accretion of black holes, accretion of phantom energy or dark energy by black holes, and there was an issue, how do these black holes grow? Well, there was a lot of discussion, but it was always a black hole accreting a test fluid, and they were discussing how the black holes grow. So if you want to do that kind of problem, you have to allow the black hole to change to be dynamical. And, well, that problem is not totally solved yet, but you work, you can get some results in the test fluid approximation, but you have to do something better if you really allow your black hole to change. Okay, now, from a point of view of physical principle, if you want to generalize black hole thermodynamics to other kind of horizons than event horizons, there are some strong claims that it's the apparent horizons that are important for the thermodynamics, not the event horizons. So this started since 1992 with Collins, and even before that. So there were some strong claims by Sean Hayward, and there is a huge amount of literature on the thermodynamics of apparent horizons, black hole horizons, and also cosmological horizons. In my opinion, there is nothing proved there, so it's not clear that there is a consistent thermodynamics for apparent horizons. There are strong claims, there are plausibility arguments, but when you actually go and try to derive a first law of thermodynamics, for example, well, people adjust the work term so that things come out to be what you should get. So there is no real proof that the thermodynamics is there. On the other hand, there are calculations of black hole temperature, Hawking temperature from dynamical apparent horizons with the Wilczek-Parik tunneling method. So people come up with the temperature, and then they say, okay, you got an apparent horizon, the entropy is 1/4 of the area. That's a big question mark for me, and that's an important question that is hard to answer. So if you think of having some kind of adiabatic approximation, slowly moving horizons should be meaningful in this approximation. So my idea here is that if you got horizons that evolve very fast, it's like having a non-equilibrium thermodynamics. How much can you do there? It's a very difficult problem. But it should make sense that if you have some slowly evolving horizon, you can construct some kind of near equilibrium thermodynamics. So this should make sense, and you should be able to find some results. The problem is finding them. I'm not really going to address these problems here. I'm just going to show you some exact solutions. Maybe this could be toy models for quantum field theory calculations, which are very difficult to do for dynamical horizons. OK. And anyway, usually black hole thermodynamics of event horizons does not postulate field equations for your theory of gravity, almost, because you got some corrections to the entropy if you got, for example, scalar tensor gravity and so on, but pretty much you can try to do thermodynamics independent of the theory of gravity. And the other area that I'm bringing in here is alternative gravity. So there is a lot of interest in alternative gravity, and you know that at some point, if you try to quantize gravity, general relativity is going to break down. It's not an issue of if it breaks down, it's where it breaks down and how it breaks down. So there are all kinds of low energy effective actions that you can build, and they always contain ingredients that are foreign to general relativity. They can be eigen derivative terms, non-local terms, non-minimally coupled scalars, all kinds of things. So these are all deviations from general relativity. And it could be that we're actually seeing the first deviation from general relativity in cosmology, because the acceleration of the universe has to be explained somehow. And if you throw in dark energy, it's just a fudge factor that you throw in, and it's very exotic, and you would never have thought about that unless somebody was telling you that the universe accelerates now, and you have to explain that. So people came up by modifying the theory of gravity instead. There are other ideas on the table, but modifying gravity would be a simple solution. So there was a lot of literature on FFR gravity and similar modifications. I counted about 1,500 papers in 10 years, which is a huge inflation of papers, but the idea is there. So you would like to know what happens in these theories, what are black holes in these theories. So these theories are designed basically to produce an effective cosmological constant which is time varying. So in that case, if you look at black holes or other spherical symmetric solutions in these kind of theories, well, these are not asymptotically flat. They are asymptotically Friedman-Roberts-Walker or something like that, because these theories, if they're interesting for cosmology, they are designed to have these built-in time-varying cosmological constant. So if you think okay, let's try to do something, let's try to understand this kind of dynamical black holes. So there are only a few exact solutions in general relativity, and even less for other theories of gravity, in which the horizons are dynamical or time-dependent, explicitly time-dependent. And I'm talking about apparent horizons. It turns out that most of the solutions that you see around are some solutions that somehow describe black holes embedded in a cosmological background. So I'll focus mostly on these, because that's what we know. So there are various notions of horizons. Maybe I can skip this part here, because I think everybody knows these things here. So the idea of the horizons is you take some congruence of null geodesics, and say, for example, a finely parameterized null geodesics, and you look at how these congruences change as you move along the congruence. You look at the expansion of the congruences, and the expansion satisfies the Ricci-Auder equation. If the congruence is not finely parameterized, you have to add a term to the Ricci-Auder equation. And this proportionality constant of the expansion here sometimes is used as a notion of gravity effect, surface gravity for black holes. I will come back to this because there are several definitions of surface gravity. And when you're thinking about doing thermodynamics, the surface gravity is essentially the temperature. Well, the temperature is surface gravity divided by 2 pi. So when I'm saying surface gravity, I'm saying essentially Hawking temperature. Okay, so you look at the congruence of outgoing and ingoing null geodesics across a surface. So in a normal surface, for example, in Minkowski spacetime, you get that one congruence expands and the other one converges when you're going in. And for a trapped surface, instead, you get that both congruences are converging, so they have negative expansions. Okay, that's because gravity is trapping the light. A marginally outer trapped surface, or marginal surface, corresponds to the expansion of the congruence of outgoing null geodesics equal to zero. So it's just on the verge of this congruence of null geodesics, it's just on the verge of falling in again. And of course, the other congruence of ingoing null geodesics has negative expansion. An anti-trapped surface corresponds to both expansions larger than zero, so that's more like a white hole or cosmological horizon situation. I will focus mostly on black hole horizons here. There is a famous theorem by Perrons from 1965. It says that if a space-time contains a trapped surface, then null energy condition holds, and there is a non-compact Cauchy surface for the space-time, then the space-time must contain a singularity. So, trapped surfaces are essential features in this concept of black hole, and they are essentially defining the concept of black hole when you have dynamical situations. So these marginally outer trapped surfaces that are going to be used are kind of different from the event horizon, so it's not totally clear what are the conditions for the existence and uniqueness of these surfaces. So the event horizon is a concept that was used in the thermodynamics of black holes, mechanics and thermodynamics of black holes in the 70s. So an event horizon is a connected component of the boundary of the causal past of future null infinity. So you define the black hole here by going to future null infinity, so you shoot all the rays and see if they go to null infinity. Basically, you go to null infinity and shoot back, and you see where is the region where the null rays actually reach null infinity, and the region from which null rays were starting, but they never make it up to null infinity. So the boundary of this region is your black hole horizon, your event horizon. So you see this definition implies that you have to know all of future null infinity, okay? And essentially all of the structure of space-time, which is not physically possible. Unless your black hole is static or stationary, then of course nothing changes, so it's a different situation. But for a realistic black hole, you're not going to know all of that, all the conformal structure of space-time. And if you're running a code trying to simulate the merger of two black holes, of course you're not going to know very much, because at some point your code crashes and you can't push it further. Okay, so this event horizon is generated by the null geodesics, which fail to reach null infinity, and as long as it's smooth, this is null hypersurface. Okay, so it's not practical to locate these apparent horizons other than very special cases, so it's basically useless for practical applications, for practical calculations, as soon as the space-time becomes dynamical. So you got some very strange situations, for example, in Evidia space-time, which is one space-time that has been used a lot to discuss horizons. So you can get a shell that collapses, and an apparent horizon forms at the center. And before the shell collapses, this apparent horizon forms at the center and expands. So if an observer is there inside that, the event horizon, is trapped and it doesn't know that there is a black hole, and somehow this event horizon knows the future, knows that a black hole will form, and the observers inside cannot go out. So it's some kind of clairvoyance property. It's very strange. So these event horizons are, after all, very strange. So again, I'm going to refer to event horizon as both the tube in space-time or the spatial slices of that. It's an abuse of terminology, but that's what everybody does. So I'll do the same. Well, people also use killing horizons. So if you think about static stationary space-time, there is a time-like killing horizon. And most of the times, this killing horizon coincides with the event horizon. The problem with dynamical black holes is that you don't have a time-like killing vector, so you cannot talk about killing horizons. There are no killing horizons. So that's also a concept that doesn't really help much in dynamical situations. So apparent horizons, an apparent horizon is the closure of a three-dimensional surface which is foliated by marginal surfaces. So this is defined by the conditions on the time slicing that the expansion of the ingoing null geodesics, of course, is negative, so these null geodesics are going in, and the expansion of the outgoing congruence is zero. So this apparent horizon is the boundary where the sign of theta L changes, so positive outside and negative inside for a black hole horizon. So these null rays momentarily stop expanding and turn around at this horizon. Okay, so as I was saying before, Yash made up a good point here. That was a good question. These apparent horizons are defined quasi-locally because in this definition, I make no mention about the future structure of space-time and only looking at the congruences of null geodesics locally. And that's all I need to define them. But this definition will depend on the foliation. So that's a big limitation of this concept of apparent horizons. So I'm not trying to hide it. It's a problem. And if you're doing spherically symmetric, considering spherically symmetric space-times, okay, well, maybe the problem is not so bad. But as soon as you get away from that, in principle, you could be talking about some quantities that are not great. They depend on the observer. They depend on the foliation. Okay, so it turns out that in non-stationary situations, apparent horizons can be quite distinct, very different from event horizons. And there are even space times in which you do not have event horizons, but you do have apparent horizons. So in general relativity, a black hole apparent horizons always lies inside the event horizon as long as the null curvature condition is satisfied. So if you're talking about general relativity, this means essentially you're the stress energy tensor satisfies the null energy condition. But when you consider Hawking radiation itself, and that's something that you want to consider if you got a black hole in the last stages of evaporation, Hawking radiation violates the weak energy condition and the null energy condition, and quantum matter in general does, and you just need to put in the picture a scalar field that is not minimally coupled to the Ricci curvature, something that you get by renormalizing, for example, lambda phi 4 theory in a curve space time, and then you violate immediately all of the energy condition. They can be violated. Okay, the other concept is the trapping horizon. So if you chart out a trapping horizon, is the closure of a surface that is foliated by marginal surfaces, such that on this two-dimensional time slicing, you get theta L equals zero, theta N less than zero, like for an apparent horizon, and then you get this condition here that is essentially distinguishing between inner horizons and outer horizons. So a trapping horizon is an apparent horizon with this extra condition built on top. I think I can skip the rest of the definitions here. They're pretty much self-explanatory. Okay, so what did people do here? When you have these dynamical horizons, apparent horizons, trapping horizons, and you want to do thermodynamics, there is one prescription that gives you actually a temperature for these horizons. That's the Parikh-Wilczek tunneling method. And if you apply that to a static black hole, you get exactly the same Hawking temperature that Hawking computed by computing Bogoliubov coefficient. So for static stationary black hole, this Parikh-Wilczek tunneling method gives you the same answer as any other method, conformal anomaly method, and so on. But when you go and look at the dynamical situations, it turns out that you cannot compute a temperature because it's very hard to do quantum field theory on a background that is changing, right? So there is this method. It does give you a temperature under some approximations. So it's a bit hidden in the formalism, but essentially you have to assume that these horizons are moving very, very slowly. So there is an adiabatic approximation, and that makes sense. With that method, you can finish the calculation, you can compute an entropy, but as far as I know, it's the only method where you can actually finish the calculation, get a result, because any other method that works for... Sorry? The Parikh-Wilczek tunneling method. And people use an Hamilton-Jacobi formulation of that. But that's the only method that works. With the other methods, you cannot do the calculation. You cannot finish the calculation. Sometimes the conformal anomaly method tells you that there must be a flux of energy, but you can't actually compute anything explicitly. So.
And you explained that the bottom horizon depends on foliation. Does the trapping horizon depend on foliation?
Yes. It's an apparent horizon, too. Well, there is this extra condition on the trapping horizon. What is it? Yeah, so the other two is the apparent horizon. In practice, people use them, interchange one and the other. There's not really a big difference. Okay, so there is one method that works for the dynamical horizon, for the apparent horizons, to compute the entropy. So, of course, you can't believe one method. You would like to have an independent check of that, but we don't have any at the moment. Nothing that I know of. It's very, very hard to get another method to give you a result that you can compare with this Parikh-Wilczek method. There are some strong statements. This is the thermodynamics and this is the temperature, but it would be nice to know something more about that. So that's an open problem. So what's the idea for this method, this method of computing the temperature?
The point is that it satisfies the first law.
Yeah. People build the first law, but what I see is that we assume that the entropy is one quarter of the area. You get a temperature from here. The internal energy, you're considering always spherical symmetry, so the internal energy is the Meissner-Sharpe-Hernandez mass, so you know the internal energy. Does this work? Well, what's the work term that you have to add in the first law? People build that, and there are different constructions of the work term, and that one, in my opinion, is just constructed so that you get a first law. If you didn't know the first law, you would never.
It's usually PDV.
It's more complicated. It's actually not simply the PDV. It depends on the space. They twiddle things around so that you get the first law. So the PDV term is constructed so that you get the first law, but you wouldn't, if you didn't know the first law, you wouldn't think of going and construct a work term that way. So to me, well, it's not really proved that there is a thermodynamic of apparent horizons. You have to be more careful than that. So basically, you make up the work term so that you write down a first law. I'm not happy about
that. I mean, I thought it works. I don't know if I've been about. I've seen people talk about it, but I bet people like this really work on it.
I think it's always, you always can, like, in a very fascinating case, you formulate the gym, like, Einstein equation in a way that it, like, looks like the first law, and then you can recognize which term should correspond to this, and then you go back.
Yeah, that's a problem. You go back and reconstruct so that things come out the way they should come out.
I don't know what Bekensman and others did. Like, they recognize that area is like speaking, so that must be
constructed. Well, there are a lot of checks. There are a lot of checks there. Also, you can compute the Hawking temperature in various methods, right? You can use the conformal anomaly.
But I mean, for entropy, that was right?
Yeah. Yeah, but this is more difficult. You see different ways of identifying the work terms, too. They contradict each other. It's not great. I mean, there is definitely there is something more to do there.
As long as there are, you know, static asymptotics, then there's a rigorous way to construct it. There's a lot of
Yes. If
it's dynamical...
That's a problem. That's one of the problems, that it's not asymptotically flat, so everything becomes more complicated.
Well, it doesn't have to be asymptotically flat. As long as there's a Hilbert-Becker asymptotically, we don't have to do this.
There isn't.
No,
yeah. No, with the killing vector you're fine. With the killing vector you can work. There is something that is kind of significant here. If you don't have a time-like killing vector, what's the next best thing that you can do? Use the Kodama vector to replace the killing vector, and that's what people do when they compute these in this Parikh-Wilczek tunneling method. They actually identify a preferred notion of time, which is related to the Kodama vector, and that identifies the temperature. That's the game. So you have to have some kind of notion of time, and you don't have the time-like killing vector to use. So people came up with the Kodama vector. Now, the Kodama vector is defined only for spherical symmetry. So, okay, I will restrict to that. It's not great, but let's try to see what we can do for spherical symmetry. So the Kodama vector essentially mimics the properties of a killing vector and originates a conserved current, which is a miracle. It's something really strange. And from that, compute the surface gravity and the temperature. So you take a spherically symmetric metric, okay? So this is the angular part of the metric, this is the area radius, and then there is the rest of the metric. So what do? The Kodama vector is essentially given by this, so take the volume form on this two space perpendicular to the two spherical symmetry, and this is the Kodama vector, so okay, it's a definition. In a static space-time, the Kodama vector is parallel to the time-like killing vector, not necessarily equal though. And here I'm not requiring anything about asymptotics, I'm just requiring that the space-time is spherically symmetric. So when it's time-like, the Kodama vector defines a preferred class of physical observer. So, and usually it's time-like if you have an asymptotically flat regions. So the important thing is that this Kodama vector is divergence-free. So from there you can actually define a Kodama current, which is the contraction of the instant tensor with the Kodama vector, and this one turns out to be covariantly conserved. And this is, by all means, is not a trivial thing. People call it the Kodama miracle. Why should you have this property? It just turns out to be true, and so there is something special about this Kodama vector, and this Kodama vector tells you the Kodama time. Another thing that is interesting is that what people use for the notion of internal energy in the first law, when the asymptotics is not asymptotically flat, well, for spherical symmetry, people use the Meissner-Sharp-Hernandez mass. This is a quasi-local, this coincides with the Hawking-Hayward quasi-local mass in spherical symmetry. The Hawking-Hayward quasi-local mass is more general. It doesn't require spherical symmetry. But for spherical symmetry, you get back this Meissner-Sharp-Hernandez mass. Now, it turns out that this is the Natter charge associated with the conserved Kodama current. And people don't seem to pay much attention to that. Sean Hayward pointed that out in his paper on old paper on quasi-local energy, but maybe we don't understand everything there. So how do you define this Meissner-Sharp-Hernandez mass? So take the spherical symmetric metric, take the area radius r, and 1 minus 2m over r is equal to the gradient square of the area radius. So m is your Meissner-Sharp-Hernandez mass. This can be cooked up in many different ways. You can write the metric in different gauges. One that I find kind of interesting is the formalism of Nielsen and Visser in a paper from 2006. So they write down the general spherically symmetric metric in this form here, in this particular gauge here. So it turns out that a posteriori this M is the Meissner-Sharp-Hernandez mass. You can change this to more familiar Pan-Levi-Goldstrom coordinates. These coordinates are such that if you take a spatial section, it's flat. So if you kill the time component here, you get only the flat metric. Then they do a bunch of calculations, and you can define these quantities here and rewrite the metric in this way here. There is a mixed term there. So in that formalism, that gauge, you compute the outgoing radial null geodesics, and you can use that in the ingoing radial null geodesics. And you can use that to compute the location of the apparent horizons. So you compute the expansion of these null geodesics, a couple of pages of calculations. You find that the condition to locate apparent horizons is when 1 minus 2m over r in that previous equation is equal to 0. Okay, so this is the definition of Meissner-Sharpe-Hernandez mass. So you want to locate the apparent horizon, you put this equal to 0. This will remind you of what you have for the Schwarzschild solution, right? So the radius, Schwarzschild radius is 2m over r. Here is more general, but it's still spherically symmetric. So you put this equal to 0, and you locate your apparent horizon. You can prove that the definition of the apparent horizon coming from the Congress of Regional Geodesics. So that means putting the gradient square of the error radius equal to 0.
So you have n as a function of t and r, but you
yes.
say that this is conserved charge, so is that really a constant?
It's the neutral charge. No, it's not a constant. So it's a function of the whatever coordinates you use, so it's a function of the radius and the time.
If there is no current, I guess that is the conserved charge. So I guess the Kodama vector was the current, or you had this JA that was the current, I forgot what.
Yeah, that was the contraction of the Kodama, the Einstein tensor with the Kodama vector.
Okay, so if that vanishes, then I guess M is conserved. But
the special current. The special current vanish. So in general, you may start, say, you don't start with these coordinates. You take a spherical symmetric metric written in whatever coordinates you want. You can still identify the area radius, right, and write down this equation, even though you don't use the area radius as your coordinate. So in that case, it may look very messy. And in this coordinate, the M may not be conserved, of course. But this what I'm finding is a recipe, easy recipe to locate the apparent horizon. So you put this area, identify the error radius, put the gradient square equal to 0. And if you're using coordinates in which the error radius is your radial coordinate, then it turns out that this equation is just GRR equal to 0 in this coordinate. So that's an easy recipe, a simple recipe to find the apparent horizons if you're using this coordinate. So you may want to use the error radius, and then you identify your apparent horizons. You can see them from the metric. If not, you can still write down your error radius in whatever coordinate you want and impose this equation. You will still find the apparent horizon. So it is a coordinate independent concept, but it depends on the foliation.
So I think the current is conserved and the M is a charge, delta charge.
Yes, exactly. And that was shown by Sean Hayward in his paper, in which he was talking about quasi-local energies, and he corrected the Hawking energy. Hawking was missing one term. Hayward added it. So I call it Hawking-Hayward quasi-local energy. For spherical symmetry is the old Meissner-Sharpe-Hernandez mass. So at the end of the day, we got this very simple recipe to locate the apparent horizons in spherical symmetry. So everything should be easy. Sometimes it's not. Okay, and if matter satisfies the null energy condition and the Einstein equation solved, the area of the apparent horizon cannot decrease. And also, the apparent horizons are always inside the event horizon if you satisfy the null energy condition in general relativity. If you satisfy the null curvature condition, so in general relativity, that's the null energy condition. Okay, so after this long introduction, I want to show you, well, it's not just an introduction, there are important concepts there. So I want to show you some strange beasts, so black holes in scalar tensor gravity. So I'll start with the wild black holes. So there is a cosmological bestiary of black holes. So if you think what is a bestiary, a medieval bestiary, was a catalog of animals. And when you look at this, some of these animals don't exist. They're pure figments of the imagination. Some of the animals in the bestiary are just gross distortions of animals that actually do exist. And some animals actually correspond to the real things that are around out there. So there is a bit of a bestiary of solutions in scalar tensor gravity. Okay, so not really many solutions known, but there is some puzzling phenomenology for this apparent horizon. So the simplest theory is Brunsdicke theory. So this is just the old 1961 Brunsdicke theory. So the scalar field phi, the Brunsdicke field, is essentially the effective gravitational coupling to the minus one. Before I jump into the scalar tensor black holes, I want to tell you about the Usain-Martinez-Nunez solution. This is a black hole solution of general relativity, but this phenomenology appears in a lot of scalar tensor black holes, and it's actually used to generate some scalar tensor black holes, cosmological black holes. So this was found by Usain-Martinez-Nunez in 1994, and it was, at that time, it was not recognized, but it gives you some really strange phenomenology of apparent horizons that was completely new at that time. It was not known. So the space-time describes an inhomogeneity in a spatially flat Friedman-Robinson-Walker background. Background in quotation marks, because of course the field equations are not linear, so you cannot really split a solution into a background and a deviation from it. There is no such splitting really. It's a nonlinear equation. Okay, so the source for this field is a scalar field, the most simple scalar field that you can think of, free, no potential, massless, and minimally coupled. So the solution looks like this. Here, eta is the conformal time of the background. So this is the metric, spherically symmetric, dynamical, and this is the scalar field, some logarithmic function. So you got constants A, B, C, and D. There is a parameter alpha, which can actually take only two values, plus or minus or 3/2. And I'm actually interested in the plus value because the other case is not very interesting. It has the conformal time, positive. And I can drop this additional constant here, B naught. As long as A naught is different from zero, B naught can be dropped. So if you put A naught equal to zero, then the metric degenerates into a metric that was known before. It's the static Fisher spacetime, which has this form here, which is also probably more well known as the Janis-Newman-Winnicore solution or Wyman solution. It has been rediscovered several times, but it was discovered first by Fisher in Russia in 1948. Okay, anyway, this is the form of that static solution. So that's a special case.
Is that free a scalar
field? It's a scalar field with a naked singularity.
But is massless a scalar field?
Massless, yeah.
So you're allowing,
Actually, no, because I'm using a coordinate here that is not the error radius. So when r equal to c, that will correspond to error radius big r equals 0. So it's a central singularity. Yes, there is a divergence here, you're right. But this small r is not the error radius you see here. The error radius is this factor here under square root times r times this to the 1 minus alpha over 2. So the error radius is not this small r. There is a singularity, but it's a central singularity in terms of physical radius, an r equals 0 singularity. Okay, so for a special, as a special case, you get a solution that is not very interesting, a scalar field with a naked singularity. The general Usain-Martinez-Nunez solution, though, is conformal to the Fisher metric, and the conformal factor is this factor in front, the square root of this factor here. So the special case is not very interesting. The general case is conformal to that, but the phenomenology and the meaning, physical meaning is completely different.
So what is alpha?
Alpha is a parameter, it's plus or minus root 3/2.
Right, okay.
Okay, so it's essentially plus or 3/2 because the negative case is not very interesting. The negative case, you get a naked singularity again, like the Fisher solution, so it's not very interesting. I'm interested in situations in which you do have apparent horizon. So you can take alpha equal plus root 3/2, so it's a fixed value. Okay, so the metric is asymptotically, so let's say that we set B equal to zero, getting rid of the special partological case. And the metric is asymptotically Friedman-Robinson-Walker for r that tends to plus infinity. And it looks, it is exactly Friedman-Robinson-Walker, Friedman-Lemaitre-Robinson-Walker if that parameter C is equal to zero. So I'll go back. So here C is a mass parameter, think of Schwarzschild, okay. Then you get exactly Friedman-Robinson-Walker. You may have to do some coordinate transformation.
So the specific background,
it's a scalar field dominated, so it would be an equation of state P equal rho. It's a stiff equation of state because it would be a massless scalar field with no potential, right? So P equal rho in Friedman-Robinson-Walker. It is a particular background. But the interesting thing is that usually when you look at McVitie solutions or other solutions for black holes in cosmological backgrounds, you put in a cosmological fluid, a perfect fluid usually, or imperfect fluid, like you guys are doing, right? But in this case, you do have a scalar field. So it's a bit more interesting as a field theory.
I said it's a perfect fluid.
You can see it as a perfect fluid in Friedman-Robinson-Walker, yes. Well, this is inhomogeneous, so it's not so easy anymore, but okay. Let's say it's a perfect fluid. So in this case, you don't have the freedom of choosing the equation of state of your perfect flow. It is fixed. Sorry, what?
Irrational powers, something?
Not in the Freeman Robinson Walker case, and not in the black hole case because it's still. No, I'm not totally sure actually if it does. There may be some strange thing, but a priori, no. A priori is just a Friedman Robinson Walker background, right? So you can choose it that way. I'm going to rewrite this metric in a way that looks a little bit cleaner. No, I don't think there is any particular chaotic behavior.
But how could there not be? I mean,
for geodesics, yeah. No, I don't think so, because it's still spherically symmetric, so I think you can get a two-dimensional phase space also in this case. I would have to check, though.
But if it's time-dependent, then there's anything preventing that.
Yeah, and also there is worse than that. At some point, the apparent horizons disappear. I'm going to show you that in a moment. So there are worse problems, but could be. Okay, so this is the Ricci scalar. Write it in whatever coordinates you want, but you see that there is a singularity here at HC. So that will correspond to the error radius, which is big R equals zero. So it's a central singularity in terms of physical radial coordinate. I can switch to co-moving time. This was not done in the original Usain Martinez Nunes paper, but I prefer to go to co-moving time instead of conformal time because I want to plot what the apparent horizons look like in terms of co-moving time so I can see what is more physical. So the relation between conformal time and co-moving time is exact. So this is the scale factor. And the solution reads like that in co-moving time. So it's a little bit cleaner. I still have that small radius in there. So this is the scalar field in this coordinate. The error radius increases for r larger than to c, so it's a well-behaved transformation. So let me call a and b these factors here. There is this parameter alpha root 3 over 2 that appears in this coefficient here. And this is, again, your error radius. So the metric. This is the metric. Now I want to express the metric in terms of the error radius so I can actually see my apparent horizons easily. When I do that, the error radius depends on the old time, the co-moving time and the small radius r. So when I take the differential, necessarily, I introduce a mixed time radius, a mixed term radius time. So I introduce I want to get rid of that mixed term there and diagonalize the matrix. So I introduce a new time coordinate, which is defined by in terms of the differentials. I have to make sure that this is an exact differential. So this condition here has to be satisfied. This function f is an integrating factor that I don't care about. In fact, it's not even unique in principle, but my results are not going to depend on that, so it's not important. So it turns out that if I choose my function beta in this relation here in this particular form, I eliminate the cross-term time radius, and the metric looks like this. So diagonal, and I can read off grr equal to zero and locate my apparent horizons. Of course, you could have done it in other coordinates. If you look at the original Usain Martinez Nunes paper, they have this relation here, and it essentially gives you the same horizon. So this is the equation locating the apparent horizon. For error radius that goes to infinity, this reduces to h to the minus 1, Hubble parameter to the minus 1, so this would be a cosmological horizon. There is no analytical way of showing this explicitly. So just take this C over R term that appears in this equation here and use it as a parameter. Then you can write the equation of the apparent horizon, left-hand side, express it in terms of co-moving time, and it gets.
So, question. So, is it the tangent of metric finite where the GR goes to zero, or is that?
The
determinant of metric. Is it finite where GR goes to zero, or is that?
GR goes to zero?
Yeah. Is the determinant finite or not?
No, so you get the coordinate singularity as you go to the apparent horizon, like you do for Schwarzschild, right?
The metric is singular. That's the thing. If the determinant is zero or infinite, then that's not apparent.
Yeah, you get the coordinate singularity in the metric right on the horizon as you get closer, like you do in Schwarzschild, right?
No, but Schwarzschild determinant is 1.
The determinant, what is it here?
Even though GRR goes to zero, GRR goes to zero. not finite at that point, then that's not.
I forgot about that one, yeah, but there is the argument that the determinant being infinite is not really telling you anything.
But that's the point, my point. If it goes to infinity, that could be just a corridor, the artifact. Then, then that's not an artifact horizon. So that's.
I forgot.
It's just that the coordinate is finite.
I forgot what it is for this one. It's also what you get. I don't know. I'll have to check that. Yeah, there was some discussion about that, but I forgot for the solution because I don't remember this one. There are several ones. Okay, anyway, so put that C over R equal to 1. Remind me, I'll check that because I don't remember. Okay, so you can just write down the equation locating the apparent horizon in a parametric form. So this parameter X is just C over R, and this you can use to plot the horizons numerically. So you get time, and as a function of S, you get the radius of the apparent horizons as a function of time, and this is the result. This is the curve that was in the original paper by Usain Martinez Nunes. They inverted the axis, but that's the result. So radius of the apparent horizons versus comoving time. So you start out near the Big Bang t equal to 0 here, and you get only one apparent horizon. Then when you reach a critical time, a pair of apparent horizons gets created. One expands, and the other one contracts. So this one that contracts eventually meets this original one that is expanding. And when you reach another critical time, these two apparent horizons, boom, disappear. So you get this creation or annihilation of apparent horizons in pairs, which is kind of strange, and people did not pay attention to that much in 1995. So I get this kind of, I call this phenomenology the S-curve phenomenology. I actually found it in a solution of F over gravity, and the apparent horizons are dynamical. At the time, I didn't know about the Usain Martinez Nunes solution, so it was discovered, I don't know. 1995. Oh, in this case, the apparent horizons are always space-like. Here? They just disappear. So you don't get solutions, so you have to solve this equation, and there are no solutions. There is only one solution after a certain time, there is only one solution before a certain time, and there are three solutions in between. Weird, but that's what it is, right? That's what you get. And these horizons here are space-like, so you can actually establish that. Sometimes it's not easy to establish if they're time-like or space-like. That's one other problem that people have with apparent horizons and trapping horizons is that very often these horizons are time-like surfaces. They're not space-like. Or they may be space-like for part of the time, then they become time-like. Here, they become actually null in this critical time here, but it's just one moment. So they're instantaneously null here. And they're space-like otherwise. It just looks weird, right? And I'm not sure what the physical interpretation is. Nobody really knows anyway. So you get a cosmological horizon that expands forever. There is these two black hole horizons in between. And one contracts, one expands, and when they meet, they disappear. And so basically you get a naked singularity in a Friedman-Roberts-Walker universe. It gets covered for a certain period of time, and then it reappears again as a naked singularity later on. And this phenomenology can be more general, so you see it also in scalar tensor theories. And sometimes in Lemaître-Mahon bonding solutions, you find multiple S's stacked one on top of the other. Of course, this is all numerical. This is the other situation for the other parameter. You just get a naked singularity embedded in a cover by a cosmological horizon, so it's a naked singularity. So that other value of the parameter is not very interesting. Okay, so another beast in the bestiary. This is a conformal cousin of this Usain Martinez Nunes solution. This is a solution of Brunswick gravity that was found by Clifton, Mott, and Barr in 2005. They have a few solutions in that paper, and they basically conformally transform the Usain Martinez Nunes solution. So they go from the Einstein frame to the Jordan frame, essentially, and they create a scalar tensor solution. They found the solution, and they didn't really bother interpreting it, so it wasn't clear if it was a black hole or what. Okay, so go and look at that. The solution looks like this. Now you got this parameter beta that is related to the Brunswick parameter. Assume that that one is larger than minus 3 over 2. So A of R is again this quantity is 1 minus 2C over R. And you got this coefficient, this exponent here, which depend on your theory. So this is something typical. So you get some spherically symmetric metric. You always get these terms here, A. And you get some weird powers that come out of particular parameters in the theory. So you got singularities at r equal to c, t equal to 0 again. So the scale factor is given in terms of the Brunswick parameter in this way. So T to some power gamma, power law. And you can go and interpret the solution, see what happens to the apparent horizons. So maybe I cut the details short here. So you look at this solution here. So just using these two quantities here to make things a little bit more compact, you get the area radius. You find that the area radius in some cases as a minimum, so as your coordinate small r that you were starting with increases, this area radius sometimes decreases, reaches a minimum, and then it increases again. So this means that the area of two spheres of symmetry decreases, you get a minimum, increases. So in that case, you have a wormhole throat joining two regions of space-time. So you have taken the Usain-Martinez-Nunes solution, you've done a conformal transformation of that, and in some cases you find a wormhole, not a black hole. In some other cases, you find a black hole. This is all detail anyway. So for the case alpha equal plus root 3 over 2, you can get a condition to find this wormhole throat. So apart from the details that are not very important, this puts a restriction on the Brunsdicki parameter. So this is not a very physical solution. It's just interesting that when you could take a black hole and you conformally transform it, you don't always find a black hole. You may find a wormhole instead. In some other cases, depending on the value of the parameters, you can actually find a black hole. So you rewrite the metric, again you do all your little tricks, and this is the metric you want to put the GRR term equal to zero to locate the apparent horizon. So you get an equation, the rest is all details, and you get the same S-curve phenomenology as for the Usain-Martinez-Nunes solution, but only for certain range of values of the parameters. In this solution, there are some special cases that Cristo Motobaro didn't pay attention to. So one case is omega equal to zero. In this case, the metric gets written this way. This is a metric that appears in the literature on Brunsdicki black holes or Brunsdicki theory. This is a particular solution of a class of the Campanelli-Lousteau metric. The Campanelli-Lousteau metric is usually reported as describing black holes. Campanelli-Lousteau black holes, so there was some fuss about that at some point. So in general, this is the general structure of the Campanelli-Lousteau metric. So the constants A and B are related to the omega parameter of Brunsdicki theory in this way. So in this case, you reproduce that metric for particular values of the parameter. Okay, so we did a paper with Luciano Vance and Sergio Zerbini from the University of Trento in Italy, and we found that this Campanelli-Lousteau black holes, in actual fact, are all wormholes. So they're reported as being black holes, but they're actually wormholes. Okay, anyway, that's one particular thing that you can get. So conformally transform a solution that is a black hole, and you can get several different other things. It's not too strange after all, because the conformal transformation can change a lot of things. And keep in mind, I'm not transforming a black hole that has event horizons here. When you conformally transform an apparent horizon, you can move the location of the apparent horizon, and the apparent horizons are not null surfaces, so they're not conformally invariant. So things can become different when you do a conformal transformation. Let's look at other beasts. There are other solutions of Brunsdicki theory by Cristo Motobaro, and I'm not going to go through the details because you're probably getting angry at this point. So again, you get a spherically symmetric metric written in some coordinates, so these are all the metric coefficients. They look a bit like Schwarzschild in isotropic coordinates or McVick in isotropic coordinates or something like that. So the alpha parameter is basically the omega parameter of Brunsdicki. And again, they wrote down the solution, but they didn't bother interpreting it. So it's easier to find solutions sometimes that understand what they go on. So we wanted to know what the solution means, what did they represent. So again, let's look if there are horizons or not, apparent horizons or not. So this is what you get. In this case, you got, sorry, I went a bit too fast, but there are parameters here. So you get this mass parameter in there, you get the Brunsdicki parameter, and you get the background, which is a perfect fluid with an equation of state p equal gamma minus 1 rho. So this gamma here is a parameter of the fluid, the background fluid. So what happens there? Well, things can change a lot depending on the region of parameter space where you are. So for some value of the parameters, you get an S-curve like in Usain-Martinez-Nunes solution. If you blow up the region here near the horizon, you get something weird. Apparent horizons that go like this. Of course, you get more parameters. You get a scale, Brunsdicki scalar field that violates all the energy conditions, so strange things can happen. For other positions in parameter space, you get apparent horizons that are like this. This is...
I mean,
radius of the apparent horizons versus co-moving time of the background.
Okay, that's the radius.
Yeah, yeah. So it's reverse with respect to the conformal, to the conformal dynamics. Okay, I just prefer to show how the radius apparent, the radius of the apparent horizon depends on the conformal time. So it's a bit unusual, but that's exactly what you see. So this is the kind of phenomenology that shows up in other solutions representing black holes in a perfect fluid Fermi Robinson Walker background, the McVitie solutions of general relativity. So you can get also that phenomenology. Again, blow up this region here, you can also get something really weird that happens again. So that's something strange. I've not seen this for apparent horizons before. Again, for other values on parameter space, you get just a naked singularity, so one apparent horizon, and these according to different values of the parameters. You can get something really strange, apparent horizons that expand to a maximum and then decrease again. So you got a lot of richness of parameters, and this was not something that we were thinking of. Going to F of R gravity, which was used to explain the cosmic acceleration a lot, well, that's essentially a scalar tensor theory. There is one static solution by Tim Clifton. Sorry, it's not static. There is another solution by Tim Clifton. And that's the one where I originally found this S-curve phenomenology. So again, I forgot all the details. It's a spherical symmetric solution. It's time dependent. It's not terribly hard to find. Tim said I was just playing around for a couple of hours with Maple or Mathematica, and they found a solution like this. So what happens is always this kind of factors here in some kind of isotropic coordinates, and the exponents here change. So the exponents are related to the theory. The theory is F of R gravity, and this F of R is R, did I write it down? Ah, yes, I did. So it reaches scalar to the 1 plus delta. Delta must be small physically if you want this theory to be compatible with solar system experiments. So say that you take delta small, this is the scale factor, and this number Q is related to delta. And that appears in all these exponents. You do the same gains that I did before, so reduce your equations locating the apparent horizons, and you get, again, the phenomenology of Doosan-Martinez-Nunez solutions. There are some other solutions around, and they get some kind of behavior like that. So you get really wild behavior, wild phenomenology, very strange things happening. So these are the wild scalar tensor black holes. What about a more physical black holes for an astrophysicist? Well, these are isolated black holes. For astrophysics, you can think that black holes can be considered as isolated, so essentially neglect as in Friedman Robinson Walker asymptotics. In that case, these black holes are a lot tamer, and you can actually get a no-hair theorem. This is a paper that I did with Thomas Sotirio a couple of years ago now. So, what we're going to do here, we're going to consider stationary black holes in the sense that they're assumed to be the endpoint of gravitational collapse. If there is some influence of the cosmological expansion on these black holes, we just throw it out because for astrophysics it's irrelevant, for astrophysical black holes now. So we're not considering primordial black holes, but we want these black holes to be axis symmetric, and we want, eventually we want them to be axis symmetric, not necessarily spherically symmetric, and we want them to be stationary at the endpoint of gravitational collapse. So in general relativity, black holes that are stationary and axis symmetric are Kerr-Newman black holes. Okay, so there's a result by Hawking in 1972 saying that if you have Brunswick theory, pure Brunswick theory without a potential, the endpoint of axis symmetric collapse must be general relativistic black holes. When you try to generalize this result to more general scalar tensor theory, for example, put a potential here, which is what you're interested in if you're doing F of R gravity or if you're doing any particle physics that you're doing, you probably put in a potential. So if you want to generalize this result, the results, people have tried to generalize these results of Mostel, Bekenstein, and collaborators. They were able to get some partial results only for spherically symmetric black holes. Realistic black holes are rotating instead, so okay, can you do anything better than that? And also you see they were pulling proofs, bits and pieces of proofs, really one piece here, 10 years later there is another piece of the proof and so on. So it's really bits and pieces. Can we do something better and can we consider more general theories? Yes, the proof is simple, and that's the last thing I'm going to show. So take this general scalar tensor theory here, you include the potential, and this metric, this action includes metric F of R gravity and Palatini F of R gravity. So pay attention to the assumptions. I'm going to require asymptotic flatness, which means I'm going to neglect the cosmological expansion. I'm going to neglect the fact that if there is a scalar here for these black holes, and it changes On a cosmological time scale, I'm just going to disregard it because I want to do something that is closer to the astrophysics or black holes now. So asymptotic flattens means that I'm going to consider scales that are less than the cosmological scale, and the scalar field must tend to a constant as the radius goes to infinity. So this means that the potential of the scalar field must be zero there. So at the value of the scalar field at spatial infinity, the potential must be zero, otherwise it's a cosmological constant and the asymptotics is not, is the sitter, is not Minkowski space. And you have to satisfy this condition if you want to have a Minkowski space in the theory. Second thing, I'm going to assume stationarity. So I want this black hole to be endpoint of collapse. So I want really the dust to settle, and I want a stationary black hole as the final product. So I can go to the Einstein frame, as people usually do. So I redefine the metric with this conformal transformation with the scalar, square root of the scalar field as conformal factor. I define my scalar field in this nonlinear way for omega different from minus 3 over 2. I can always redefine this. And I can turn my action into the Einstein frame action, in which it looks like the action of general relativity with a minimally coupled scalar field in the canonical term. The potential is dual potential divided by phi square. But now my new field is big phi. So this is some more complicated function of the big phi. And I got this anomalous coupling between matter and the scalar field. Because I'm going to consider vacuum, nothing outside of the black hole, this term here can just be thrown out because I'm outside. These are the usual Bernardicki equations. The conformal transformation was using the scalar field as a conformal factor, right? So the scalar field has the same symmetries in the Einstein frame, has the same symmetries as the scalar field in the Jordan frame. And the symmetries are preserved by the conformal transformation. So this means that there is a time-like Killing vector associated to stationarity that we call xi mu, and a space-like Killing vector at spatial infinity, theta mu, which is associated with axial symmetry. Okay. We're in vacuum, consider this region of space-time, a four-dimensional volume that is bounded by the horizon tube in the space-time, an initial Cauchy-Epper surface S1, and the final Cauchy-Epper surface S2, and spatial infinity. So we got these regions here. So I'm going to take the field equation in the Einstein frame for the scalar field, multiply by the first derivative of the potential, and integrate over this region of space-time, just because it gives me some results. Okay, so why do I want to multiply by u prime when I have box phi equal to u prime? Because then I get a u prime square here, and I can write down the field equation this way, integrated over that volume view of space-time. Then I can use the usual identity for u prime box phi, so I can rewrite this as u second green square of phi plus u prime square, take it to the other side, let me change the sign here, and this is equal to the integral on the boundary of the flux of u prime gradient phi. Okay, so n mu is the normal to the boundary. H is the determinant of the induced metric H mu on this boundary. Now I split this boundary into its four components. So there is the horizon, first Cauchy-Epper surface, second Cauchy-Epper surface, and spatial infinity. So there are four pieces of that integral. Okay, what happens to these four pieces on the integral? Well, the integral over the first Cauchy-Epper surface is the opposite of the one on the second Cauchy-Epper surface, because I've assumed stationarity, so the integrand is the same on this surface and on this other surface, only the direction of the unit normal is the opposite on this two upper surface. So these two integrals on the Cauchy-Epper surface cancel out. The integral at spatial infinity is zero because the gradient of the scalar field goes to zero there. I've assumed asymptotic flatness, or I'm throwing out the Kramer-Robertson-Walker asymptotics if it is there. So all that is left is the rest, the integral on the horizon. The integral on the horizon is actually also equal to zero because you're integrating u prime box gradient phi, so you're projecting that on the unit normal, and because of the symmetries, this integral here is equal to zero. So at the end, all this integral on the boundary is equal to zero, so this is also equal to zero, and that's what I get here. So what do I have there? U prime square is obviously non-negative. This is double mu phi times u second. Now, I'm assuming that the black hole is the end point of collapse, so I must form an object that is stable. Then u second is non-negative also, because if you were near the maximum of the potential or away from the minimum of the potential, you don't form a stable object. So there will be some solutions that violate my results, but that's because they're not stable. Here I'm imposing stability. So this is a very physical assumption. It's not really just a math assumption. And then because you are on the horizon there, sorry, because nabla mu vanishes inside this volume, and you want to have a minimum of the potential, u prime is equal to zero. So this term is actually equal to zero. This term here must also be equal to zero because the integral is zero. This is non-negative, the integral is zero, so this term must be also zero. So what does this tell you? That the gradient of phi is equal to zero in that volume, so the field is constant in that volume. I'm considering Brzezinski theory. If you put the scalar field equal to constant, we have general relativity. So that's the end of the story. Under these assumptions, which are physically very strong, I'm assuming stationarity and assuming asymptotic flatness, the theory reduces to general relativity, so the black holes must be Kerr black holes. The only case that is not covered here is the case of, okay, so metric f over gravity is covered because that corresponds to a special case of Brzezinski theory with small omega equal to zero and some complicated potential, so that's covered. Palatini f over gravity is not really strictly speaking covered because that corresponds to omega equal minus 3 over 2. And I threw out that case. It was not included here, but we know that in vacuum, Palatini f over gravity reduces to general relativity. So Hawking theorem applies there, and that's the same result that we have here. I could add an electromagnetic field. Instead of vacuum, I could have an electromagnetic field. That one has zero trace, and the trace is all that appears in the field equations. So I could get the same results. Exceptions that are not covered by the proofs are theories in which omega diverges somewhere. That one is not included because then your conformal transformation diverges, you get problems there. So if you got theories like that, well, they're not covered. Theories in which the scalar field diverges at infinity or diverges on the horizons are also not covered because they screw up my proof. And there are some solutions like that that are quoted as counterexamples to the theorem of Hawking. So there is the most famous one is the Maverick solution of Bocharova and others in 1980. But that one is known to be unstable. Hideki Maeda has shown that one is unstable. So again, that's why it evades the proof, because I was considering only stable and points of collapse. And you can extend the proof to electrovacuum or conformal matter without any problems. Okay, so I'm going a bit too long here. Anyway, I'm at the conclusions. So the proof actually in this case was simple because I can show it all, and normally it's years and years and years before you add a little piece to the proof. So this one came out nicely. We were really lucky to do that. So to conclude, there is a rich Bayes theory of phenomenological horizon. These apparent horizons can have really wild phenomenology. So if they are embedded in a cosmological background, or in principle if you have solutions for dynamical apparent horizons, I expect some strange things to happen also there. So this is really we don't understand. And we still have the problem, are these apparent horizons the right quantities to consider? Well, they are foliation dependent, so it's not great. But that's the best we have so far. Then other questions are, can you make sense of the thermodynamics of these objects? When I started working on these, I was actually, my goal was, let's find some solutions in which I have some explicit analytic expression for the apparent horizons, and then I can try to do some thermodynamics there, maybe do some quantum field theory in cross space with that. But if you don't have some explicit expressions for the apparent horizons, it's hard to do. Turns out there are not many solutions in which you get explicit analytical expressions for the apparent horizon. So it's going to be very hard to check the thermodynamics. Is the Kodama prescription correct? Yeah, it looks nice. You got this preferred time, you get the net charge, which is the internal energy. But is it really correct? I don't know. There are conflicting views here, and that's an open problem. It should make sense that in some adiabatic approximation, you can make sense of the thermodynamics. But again, there are not really many results on this. Okay, so, and for isolated black holes, asymptotically flat black hole, if you consider the astrophysics and you throw out the cosmological asymptotics, and black holes that are stable, then point of collapse that are stationary and stable, everything instead is very, very nice. It's the same as in general relativity. I don't know anything really about other theories like orbital gravity or Einstein ether. Their structure of the horizon is something very different again, so there are even bigger problems in those cases. And I think that all these problems actually deserve some attention, and I don't see a lot of going on in this field, but maybe if you think about that, you can get some ideas and let me know. And that's all. Thank you very much. No. This last proof for the asymptotically set because it's actually four axis symmetric. I'm not assuming spherical symmetry. So that's the difference with all the previous work, that they were always assuming spherical symmetry. And it was, even then, it was pulling pieces here and there. It was hard to get results. Now, this is really four axis symmetric black holes. So that's a nice part of it, that is not restricted to spherical symmetry. But you cannot put in a cosmological constant or other asymptotics, otherwise it really screws up the proof.
So in your theorem, you're assuming stationarity.
Yes.
Could anything else happen if you imagine a collapsing stellarized star? What are your, beyond intuition,
well,
your expectation that
you get some results, actually, because people have been following apparent horizons during the collapse in Brzezinski theory, right? So you get apparent horizons that actually go inside and outside of the event horizon in those cases. And that can happen because the Brzezinski scalar field violates the energy conditions. So you can get strange things there. I've assumed that everything is settled at the end. That's
right,
it.
So what could be a way to not get to that settling stage?
I'm pretty much ruling that out by assuming that I'm considering only the end point of collapse. So I cannot really do it. Well, I don't know. I suppose you can get, if you don't get stuck in the stable state, you can possibly get anything. Well, of course, you can get, this is axisymmetric, so you can get potentially also scalar radiation, right?
Right.
And the apparent horizons, in principle, they can do anything. They go in and out of the event horizon, which should never happen in general relativity. So if you're actually interested in following the dynamical situations, actually, I don't know, I should ask you because it's all numerical work, right? You cannot do anything analytically there. You can expect wild things to happen because you got this black hole and there is some matter around, right? So the simplest thing is to put a Freeman Robertson Walker background there. That one is nice and you can control it. So you get some strange phenomenology of apparent horizons there. So in a sense, locally you get the same if you get matter that is collapsing, right? So you can expect all kinds of strange phenomenology. Change your parameter space, change the fluid, and it's not, maybe it's not a perfect fluid, and it's a very dynamical fluid. So I don't know. Could be really wild. Thank you.